Good morning, everybody, and welcome to episode 38 of our monthly live Q&A session with Cinten's employment team. I'm David Pritchard, Head of Marketing at Cinten's. We have a treat for you this morning. We have three speakers who I have just popped up on your screen there. So we have Partner and Head of Department Keith Land. We have Max Winthrop, who has recently just joined us as a partner, and we have trainee solicitor Lucy Milthorpe. So moved away slightly from the format of two people, but you're getting a lot of information there this morning. The questions are there in front of you. As usual, this is three questions that you've put forward to us over the course of the month. So enough from me. I'm going to pass you straight over to Keith, who is going to unmute himself. And he is going to start proceedings. Keith, good morning and over to you.
Thanks for the reminder, David, because I would have waffled on with my mute on. So that was a good start. Right. First question of three. Can I have a selection pool of one person in a redundancy exercise? The answer is yes. So that's me finished. And no, only joking. It's an interesting question. And I think it's probably come about given the recent EAT case in McGann, I don't know how you pronounce it, versus Bradford Teaching Hospitals NHS Foundation Trust. I don't know that for certain, but I'm a good guesser. Okay, so in that case, I'll deal briefly with it and then I'll get into that question. McGann's department was unprofitable. A decision was made that that department was going to be self-sufficient. So they had to reduce cost and therefore lose employees. McGann was on a fixed term contract and her contract was up for renewal first. And so they said, right, OK, that's the criteria. Her contract is up for renewal first, so we're going to displace her as redundant because we're not going to renew the contract. OK, she was dismissed. And the question was that a reasonable manner to dismiss somebody by reason of redundancy? The EAT basically said no, because in effect, the criteria was decided prior to any kind of selection or consultation exercise. Okay, now coming back to the question, can you have a selection pool of one? Well, when you're faced with a redundancy situation, you've got a couple of basic questions to answer. First, is there a redundancy situation falling within section 98 of the Employment Rights Act 2006? That question is probably beyond this question today, because that's a whole session in itself, which I can't get done in 5 or 10 minutes. But assume the question is there's a valid redundancy situation. What then do you have to do? Well, you then have to set about coming up with a fair manner of selection, and that involves the selection pool and the criteria used to select those employees who are redundant. The lead case, if you are a geek like me, is a case called Williams versus Compare Maxim Limited. If you want to look that up, have a read if you're faced with redundancy exercise. It gives five basic principles that you've got to follow in any redundancy exercise. You give warning in advance and you consider alternatives before you start dismissing people as redundant. You consult with employees or the union and agree the pool and the criteria for selection. It is the employer who picks the selection criteria, and it has a relatively wide remit to do that, so long as they are objective. You then get into the fourth, which is for selection to be fair, you've got to select employees in accordance with the agreed criteria. And then latterly, you've got to look at alternative employment. So you've got to roll all of that into your redundancy exercise, and I'll apply that to a selection pool in a second. The case of McGann then looked at other important decisions, one being Polkey versus AE Dayton Services, which says in any redundancy exercise, an employee must have a fair basis for selection. And it then looked at Freud versus Bentalls Limited. I'm calling it Freud. It's F-R-E-U-D. Given my misspent youth, I can't get past Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure and Freud, but never mind. Freud, whatever you want to call it, the principle in the case is there must be consultation with an employee in advance of decisions being made, so the employee can understand whether there is another way forward than making dismissals. As I've said in McGann, decision was taken on the selection pool prior to consultation taking place, and they found that that position was unfair. What the EAT also said, which is an important factor here, is that every employer has an implied duty of trust and confidence, which effectively means that an employer will not behave arbitrarily towards that employee. And that applied equally in a redundancy situation. And the suggestion was that therefore you've got to behave fairly reasonably in handling that redundancy situation. So in answer to the question, can you have a pool of one? Well, yes, I think you can still have a pool of one despite what was said in McGain, but you must consider the selection pool as one of the matters that you consider before you start the redundancy exercise. Do you have a selection pool of one person, or do you have a selection pool of 10 from which you need to pick one person? That is a fundamental decision before any employer. Now, the good part about this is that the law says that if an employer applies its mind to a particular question, such as the selection pool, and it has reasonable grounds for drawing it in a specific way, then an employment tribunal cannot interfere with it, except where the employer has taken a decision that no reasonable employer would take. So when you're faced with a redundancy exercise, what's your selection pool? Is it one person, or is it 10 people, or is it 100 people? What are the factors you have to consider? Well, you've got to consider the employee that you're considering making redundant, or the employees you're considering making redundant, and decide whether there are other employees doing similar work. You've then got to consider whether jobs are interchangeable. Do people swap in and out of different roles? And if so, therefore, it seems that they're doing similar jobs and they should be in a wider selection pool rather than just one person. Isn't employees, the third point is an employee's treatment within a pool with other employees consistent with what has been done in the past and consistent with their position? Lastly, is there an agreed manner of treating people with a trade union or an employee representative body that dictates that you should behave in a certain way in these kind of circumstances? If you've carried out that analysis as to whether jobs are interchangeable, because that is one of the biggest factors, whether their employees doing similar work, and you've concluded that there is one person, i.e. only one job affected by this redundancy exercise, and you don't have a wider selection that you're picking one person from 10 people that do a similar role, yes, I think you can still have a selection pool of one. However, my view would be, following the McGain case, is that as an employee, you've got to come forward with proposals. Those proposals are such that you would then have to put them to the workforce or the unions or the individual and consult on them at a formative stage before you have made final decisions. What went wrong in McGain is that they made a decision, then tried to consult afterwards. The case of McGain does say you've got to consult with employees at a formative stage before final decisions are made, so you can iron out how you're going to select people as redundant, and therefore everything flows from that planning exercise in advance. Got to come forward with proposals. Once you put those proposals out there, you consult on them, and then you reach the decisions in terms of who is selected, who is not. Hope that answers the question. I'm going to pass you over to Lucy, who is going to deal with a bit of stuff on right to work checks.
Hi everyone, I'm Lucy, the new trainee solicitor in the employment team. So the question that I'm going to be answering is, how should right to work checks be carried out? Because there has been a couple of changes to this that came in this month. As I'm sure you'll all know, right to work checks need to be carried out on all prospective employees before their employment commences, and this is regardless of their nationality. So employees who have conducted and recorded a compliant right to work check will have a statutory excuse in the event that the worker is found to be working illegally, and this will provide you with a defence to any liability for a civil penalty. Some of you may be aware that due to the pandemic, adjustments were made to right to work checks which allowed employers to conduct these checks digitally. And from the 6th of April this year, it was made possible for British and Irish nationals right to work checks to be carried out using identification validation technology. I'm sure some of you might have utilised this option. So from the 1st of October, there are now three ways in which the right to work checks can be carried out. And these are either a manual check of the documents, a digital check using an identity service provider, or an online right to work check via the Home Office. So the method which must be used will depend on the immigration status of the individual and the documents that they hold. So for individuals who have either an E visa, biometric residence permit, biometrics residence card, or a frontier worker permit, a check must be done using the online right to work check via the Home Office. A manual check of these documents is no longer compliant. So employees will need to request a share code from the prospective employee, and this will allow them to check the right to work check using the online service. So this will enable you to ensure that the prospective employee has the right to work to carry out the work that's actually being offered by you. And this will also inform you if there's a time limit on this right to work, and it's advisable to keep a note of this date just for future reference. You'll also need to meet with the prospective employee in person or via video call just to verify that the photo matches the individual that's on the document. And you should keep a copy of this on file, which shows that they have the correct status to do the work in question. You should also certify this copy just to confirm that you've seen the original document just by adding your signature and name and a date that the check took place. So for those who fall outside the scope of the online check, which is essentially British and Irish nationals, you can either do these checks manually by checking the identification documents, or if the individual has a British or Irish passport, employers can use an identity service provider. So I'll start with the manual check first. So when doing this, this must involve seeing the original document. If it's not possible to see the person face to face for the check, then the documents must be posted out to you. And then you can verify the photo matches via video, provided that you have these documents in your possession. And then again, a clear copy should be taken of the documents. And then you need to verify with your signature and name that you've seen the originals. So if you want to use an identity service provider, the government website has provided a list of certified service providers. And although it's not mandatory to use one of these certified providers, it is recommended to do so just because this would provide you with the extra reassurance that the service provider that you've chosen meets the relevant standards for carrying out these checks. Because even though you're using one of these providers, it's still ultimately the employee's responsibility to ensure that all right to work checks are compliant. And again, you should meet with the employee face to face or via video call just to check that the photo on the passport matches the individual. So when deciding which method to use for British and Irish prospective employees, employers should evaluate their workforce and staff turnover to work out whether they wish to utilise the identity service provider option. The method does come with a cost. There's no set fee, so you can essentially shop around until you find one that you're happy with. But despite the cost, you may still find that this is the preferred method in order to carry out right to work checks more efficiently. So our advice to employers is to just basically make sure that the staff who are responsible for carrying out the right to work checks are up to speed with these changes, and just to ensure that they understand which method must be used in each situation. So this could involve providing training to these members of staff just to ensure that all checks that are being carried out are compliant. So that covers everything that I wanted to say. So I'll pass you on to Max for our last question. Thank you.
Good morning, everybody. I'm very pleased to be here. So I'm Max Winthrop, and I joined Sintons just a month ago. So question has been put, should I use a COT 3 or should I use a settlement agreement when I want to end an employment related dispute? Well, I suppose the quick answer to that is it all depends. Obviously, that's rather an irritating answer to give if you get it from a lawyer. But let's kind of just unpack the concepts behind those two types of agreement, because I think that'll show the sort of circumstances where you might want to use one rather than the other. So if you go right back to the start of when Parliament first gave people the right to claim things like unfair dismissal, there was a feeling that sneaky employers would get employees to sign away those rights even before they started work. So there's always been statutory protection against signing away your statutory employment protection rights, things like unfair dismissal and the rights to protect you from discrimination. So for those rights to be extinguished, certain things have got to happen. So either you've got a COT3 agreement, that's an agreement through ACAS that satisfies the requirements in the Employment Tribunals Act 1996. That's kind of like the sister act to the Employment Rights Act. Or you've got to have some other form of agreement that satisfies the stipulations set out section 203 of the Employment Rights Act. So let's look at COT3s first of all. Now, if any of you have had experience of settling through a COT3, you'll realise it's relatively straightforward. What generally happens is that the parties will communicate, often by phone through ACAS, and agree terms, and a standard and relatively short document will be produced. It might be as simple as something saying, for example, the claimant accepts the sum of £3,000 in full and final settlement of all claims arising or in connection with the employment contract. Job done. Once ACAS has communicated that, even before the ink is dry or even put on the COT3 agreement, the parties have reached a binding agreement. So nice and straightforward. Now, what does it cover? Well, there's an interesting case on that recently called Avranescu and Quick Release Automotive Limited. Now, I don't know the detailed background of this, but Avranescu was only with Automotive for a relatively short period of time in 2014, a couple of months. And for whatever reason, a race discrimination case was brought. And that seemed to rumble on because it wasn't until March of 2018 that the parties got round to producing a COT3 agreement. COT3 agreement settled the claims. However, that wasn't the end of the story, because Avranescu then brought further proceedings based on the fact that a subsidiary company of Automotive had actually turned her down for employment. Now, at first instance, the tribunal said this is just fanciful nonsense, strike it out. There was an appeal. And at the appeal, the EAT kind of rode back on that and said, oh, hang on a minute, you've got to be a little bit more careful here. You've got to carefully analyse what's being raised as a claim. And in this case, the slightly unusual feature was that Avranescu was arguing that because her application for a job had been turned down, first off, that looked a bit like victimisation under Section 27 of the Equality Act. But in actual fact, EAT said, no, what this is really all about is a claim for aiding and abetting under Section 112 of the Equality Act, not a very frequent claim. So they said, yes, potentially there's a claim there. It isn't fanciful, and it's something that should go forward to a tribunal, except you've signed a COT3. And the funny feature of this, of course, is that the actual turning down of the new job had been in February of 2018, whereas the COT3 wasn't signed until March. So on that basis, the EAT were able to say, well, in fact, that COT3 covers you for all claims and for all time. Now, note that funny kind of chronology there. Conceivably, even with a COT3, if you were talking about a classic victimisation claim coming about through giving a Duff reference, that might not necessarily have fitted within that. But the broad takeaway from that is that that COT3 covered more or less everything that could be raised. Now, contrast that with a settlement agreement. Now, many of you will have seen these. Many of you will have been involved in drafting them. Compared to the COT3, settlement agreement is a lot longer document. Why? Well, because for the settlement agreement to work, you've got to raise the particular complaint that's going to be compromised. So, simple case where you're only talking about unfair dismissal, all you'd need to do would be to put unfair dismissal as the complaint raised and compromised. But of course, settlement agreements tend to be used before parties are in the tribunal, and they tend to be used on the basis that, well, we're kind of contracting out of every possible claim. So it's quite strange. I often see, when I've been acting in the past for employees, all sorts of weird and wonderful things that the settlement agreement purports to remove, you know, rights under the transnational consultation regs for a guy who works in a corner shop, for example. But that aside, the reason for that is, as I mentioned earlier, unless you specify the claim you're contracting out of in the settlement agreement, it won't work. Now, that's kind of graphically illustrated in a recent case called Bathgate and Technip. Again, slightly unusual feature about this. Basically, Mr. Bathgate going, originally he was to have certain types of payment, signed up an agreement to that effect, a settlement agreement. After the settlement agreement signed, change of view, and one of the payments was withdrawn to those that were over 61, as Mr. Bathgate was. So he then brought an age discrimination claim, and the tribunal held that that could go forward. Now, it could go forward even though the COT 3, sorry, get my terminology right here, even though the settlement agreement has specifically referred to age discrimination. Well, why is that? Well, because age discrimination in that context was a general prohibition on bringing a claim, but it didn't relate to the particulars. The particulars couldn't have been part of that agreement because they only arose from the decision that Technip took to withdraw the payment to those over 61 after the signing of the COT 3 agreement. So, settlement agreement. Right, so let's try and kind of deduce from that what we might be doing. Well, in many disputes in the tribunal, the COT 3 agreement is going to be the obvious route to resolution. And of course, nowadays we have that early conciliation process, which brings in ACAS at an early stage, and that might well indicate that if you've already started, or the claimant's already started early conciliation, the COT 3 is the obvious document to use to end that dispute. Nice and simple, requires ACAS to be involved in the process, but little more than that. And those very broad terms will cover more or less everything that's likely to occur. Now, you may be in a different kind of area though, but if you've got something a little bit more sophisticated going on, if you've got, for example, a situation where supposing a plant is closing, but you need certain key people to stay on within the plant for a particular period of time and then leave, you might want to have a much more sophisticated agreement that allows for sort of a loyalty bonus to be paid and to deal with those sorts of issues. And then you're kind of really going towards the settlement agreement side of things. Also, you may have a director type level agreement. Again, you might then want to deal with all the complexities of share transfer through a settlement agreement. So I suppose the short answer back to where we started really depends on the facts. COT 3s have the blessing of simplicity, but the employment relationship can be complex, and that might push you towards a settlement agreement. So with that, I will hand you back to David.
Thank you very much. Enjoyed listening to all of those. A few bits from me. We continue to work hard to produce and deliver and release relevant and useful content, articles, podcasts, blogs, all of which can be found on our website, www.sintons.co.uk, should you wish to take a look. And that includes all episodes of this live Q&A session. If you'd like to discuss anything the team have raised today further, well, they're there in front of you with their contact details, so please don't hesitate to get in touch. They'll be delighted to take your inquiry and speak to you. Social media, you can follow the team on Twitter at SintonsHR. Couple of other things I just wanted to mention. We held our employment update seminar last week at the Eagles. We had a fantastic turnout, and it was a very, very good couple of hours. We recorded this, we've edited it. I have the duty of listening to it three times, once when we record it, once when I edit it, and then once when I play it back to make sure everything's as it should be. So we'll be releasing that out next week, so please do take an hour and a half just to watch it. It is a very, very good session and very, very well attended. And we were just joking before we started, because this is Lucy's first time doing one of these, about the amount of people that are tuning into these sessions. And we do slightly, tongue in cheek, I suppose, take it slightly for granted. But there's just short of 1,200 people who are live on this session this morning, which is a staggering amount. This is something that Keith and I put together during COVID back in April 2020 and has just grown and grown and grown. And then the amount of people who will watch this afterwards exceeds for these 15,000 people. So we don't take it for granted. We generally did just say it to scare Lucy this morning, but obviously she did very well. So really just wanted to say thank you once again for tuning in. We do generally appreciate it. And while this continues to add value, we'll continue to do it. Next session will be with you on the last working Friday of November. Can't believe we'll be in November. Stay safe, everyone. Have a great weekend. Thank you for listening, and we'll speak to you next month.